Welcome to a new and special episode of the Tax Quartet, the podcast of the German Journal for International Tax Law, IWB. Today, we want to shed light on the Pillar 2 topic from the perspective of five different countries. That's why we are listening to us as a Tax Sixtet. Nadja is joining me today as a co-host. She will also provide some insight from Germany. Many greetings to Eva and Florian, who, of course, helped us with the preparation in the background. We are very delighted today that we have our international guests with us, Maria from Sweden, Andreas from Luxembourg, Pachi from Spain, and Joe from the US. Nadja, I'll hand over to you to start with the introduction.
Thank you, Matthias. The first guest I want to introduce is Maria Norlin. Maria is a tax partner with Gepson Scott in Sweden, which is the largest independent tax advisor firm in Sweden. And she has over 20 years of experience as an advisor to both Swedish and foreign clients active in various industries. And Maria has a particular focus on international taxation and on corporate tax issues, such as tax reporting and filings, tax consolidations, withholding tax issues and settlements of foreign tax. Restructuring within Sweden and cross-border, and Maria and I have been working together as well already on several clients with Pillar 2 issues. So thank you very much for taking the time and being here today, Maria.
Thank you, Nadja. Happy to be here.
Hi, Maria. Andreas is the next one. Andreas Medler is partner in the International and Corporate Tax Department at Atos. I think Atos is the right spelling, right? The largest independent tax advisory firm in Luxembourg, and he is actually from Germany. Hi, Andreas.
Hi, everybody.
The next guest is Pachi Arazate from Garrigues. He is a partner in the corporate tax department, and Garrigues is the largest tax law firm in Spain. And Pachi is as well specialized in international taxation and M&A and has worked for multinational and local Spanish clients for over 20 years as well, and is also closely involved with the Pillar 2 project and the Spanish implementation. Hi, Pachi.
Hello, thank you.
And we say hello to Joseph Sullivan. Joe is an associate at Covington and Burling. Is that right? Yes, hope so. Almost in Washington, D.C., where he advises multinational clients on cross-border tax planning and complex domestic tax controversy work. He has significant experience and expertise in tax policy and legislative initiatives, and he was also actively involved in the OECD Pillar 2 project. Hi, Joe.
Hi, everyone. Thanks.
So we want directly start with our content. And the first question goes to you and is, where do you stand actually in your country with the Pillar 2 project? Is the law already finalized? And when do you expect will it be introduced in your country? And the first question goes to Maria.
Yes, in Sweden, we do have, I would say, a finalized government bill issued. This government bill is to be decided of by mid-December. So nothing more is expected than that this will be taking a decision of by mid-December so that it will be passed until 1st of January 2024. So this has been reviewed and is final by the Legislative Council, etc. So all set.
Andreas, how is it in Luxembourg?
Actually, just today we have received like the amended version of the law, which is like now in a status which could be compared to Regierungsentwurf in Germany. So we're coming closer to finalization. We faced the particular challenge of having having had national elections like a month ago. Fortunately, like the new coalition seems to have been formed and will be announced in the coming 1 to 2 weeks. So we're relatively optimistic to have the draft law voted by the end of the year.
Pachi, in Spain, what is the current status?
In Spain, the directive implementation process has been suspended due to election for a while, from July. And now that we're going to have a new government, it looks like the project will pass. But I don't expect it to happen during 2023. I'm expecting it to happen in the first months of 2024. And even I'm not sure if we will see a project before year end, because we haven't seen any kind of paper in Spain yet.
Wow, that's quite unusual and very challenging for your clients. How do you treat this situation? Are you still preparing with your clients or?
Yeah, I mean, working on the basis of the directive directly, but there are many, many things still pending to be decided, because we have a quite complex tax system in Spain with 5 different jurisdictions. So there's a lot to work that we can do with the directive, but still a lot of work that we can't do until we see how it's going to be implemented from the technical perspective.
Yeah, I guess from a German perspective, we are quite comfortable. I think all the German listeners followed the decision of the parliament last Friday. Joe, what is happening in the US? Is Pillar 2 a subject for your clients? I mean, we heard a lot that the US is not really following. What is the US standpoint?
Yeah, well, go into some detail on how the politics are shaking out a bit later, but just from a, you know, advice to clients perspective, I started following this 3 or more years ago, I guess, when those first blueprints came out. And I think at that time in the US, folks were pretty skeptical that anything would be adopted. I think I read them and maybe 10 or 12 other people did. And everyone else viewed those blueprints and the whole project as, I would say, somewhat of a novelty, you know, something that wasn't likely to pass. And even if it did, why invest the time in learning the rules then when they're as complex as they were? That all changed last year with the Pillar 2 directive. This year, my understanding is, and my observations of clients have been so far, that this is the number one priority for U.S. clients now, particularly in the last 6 months, as tax departments have had to think about how these rules are going to go into effect next year in a lot of jurisdictions, and how that's going to be reality. For U.S. multinationals, I think, you know, obviously we are not likely to have rules anytime soon, but figuring out how these rules are going to impact, you know, subsidiaries and even the U.S., depending on how which rule is applicable, is taking a lot of time for tax departments. So yeah, they're laser focused on it at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because my impression was for a long time that many US clients didn't have it on the radar at all, but then apparently it became reality for you too.
Last year, that was certainly the case. You couldn't get clients to care about it. Now that has changed, certainly.
And what are your expectations for the US adopting some sort of Pillar 2 or making GILTI more Pillar 2 compliant?
Yeah. So, and I'll talk about this a bit later, but no plans to adopt anything that looks like Pillar 2 right now in the US. And in fact, not only are there no plans to do so, there's no legislative vehicle to do so. Listeners may recall that the US passed, at least in the House of Representatives, the Build Back Better Act a couple of years ago that looked kind of like Pillar 2. It was trying to bring the US closer to Pillar 2. The Biden administration is certainly supportive of Pillar 2. Democrats in Congress are supportive of Pillar 2. But that bill failed to pass the Senate, kind of by one vote. It failed at the last minute. And there has not been a proposal to reintroduce Pillar 2 legislation. And with U.S. elections next fall, it's very unlikely we'll get any sort of substantial bill. And with Pillar 2 being as controversial as it is in the U.S., more on that later, even if we did get a bill, it's highly unlikely to contain anything that would bring Pillar 2 into U.S. law. So, you know, as we'll discuss in a bit, whether Pillar 2 becomes law in the U.S. depends almost entirely on the result of the election next year. If Democrats win, very likely we'll get something that looks like Pillar 2. If Republicans win, we will see what happens. And then there are all sorts of other options. If there's split, you know, if the houses and the administration are split, you know, you never know what could happen.
Yeah, just for completeness sake, so we had our parliament deciding on the law on Friday, And we will have the council decide on it by end of the month, and then it will be published before Christmas.
You guys are a lot farther along.
Germans, but, good peoples.
We are seeing now the European legislation coming, but Pillar 2 is still a moving target in a way that we expect some OECD guidance coming afterwards. So the next question for us is, how you treat these in your domestic legislation? For example, you know, the current discussion on DTL recapture and that something will come from the OECD. How will you transpose this into your domestic law? We start with Germany, as we have an interesting discussion also in Germany. So, Nadia, how's it here?
Yeah, exactly. This is a question that we are that I don't have the answer to, but it's something that is being discussed on multiple levels. I mean, in Brussels, they're discussing how they go about it if the further OECD guidance is in fact not only clarifying the wording of the directive, but is exceeding or contradicting certain provisions. And my feeling is that one of them could be the further guidance on DTL recapture that is envisaged to be published by end of the year. At some point, it was like announced to be published before the summer, but then they couldn't get agreement on it, on how to simplify it. So for everyone who's not as deep in Pillar 2, that's for deferred tax liabilities. If they exist for longer than 5 years, then you have to recapture them and you cannot use the tax expenses that you booked for this deferred tax liability. And because everyone, all the businesses said, okay, we do not have those information on an item by item base, but we just have it position based, there were discussions how to simplify that. And we will now have further guidance by end of the year. And yeah, it's not definitely not in the law that has been decided on Friday. So there will be some clarification. And then the question is how we will do it in Germany. Will we have like a publication of the federal ministry, like a BMF schreiben? Or will we have Reparaturgesetz, correction law, that is like just replacing the old law once there is enough further guidance issued? But it makes it obviously very difficult. And I mean, Patchy is in a perfect situation for that. What do you advise clients with when you know there is something else coming? It's not going to be in line with the wording of the directive. And how do you prepare for that? So, Maria.
Yes, that's a really interesting question. And this has been quite a lot commented, actually, in the preparatory work in the to the Swedish government bill. And the Swedish government, first of all, they, of course, commented that it's been a challenge to of course, implement this directive while there's so much going on and so much clarifications that are to come through guidance still. But they are quite clearly stated in the preparatory work that, of course, the model rules, the commentary and the administrative guidance will play an important role to interpret the legislation, since it's a directive-conform legislation that is decided of. What they've also said is also that if there will be further guidance issued that is kind of outside the wording of the law, which is, if the clarification fits within the current Swedish wording of the law, then they would not need to issue further legislation. But as long as if there comes guidance which is outside the wording of the law, there will be new legislation issued in Sweden. So they expect that there will be changes in the legislation onwards. When it comes to more specifically related to the recapture rule, there has also been already at this stage some comments made, kind of more applying to specific Swedish things, which are like we do have tax allocation reserves for instance, in Sweden, which is basically that you set off 25% of the taxable result to, and you don't have it subject to tax this specific year, but you can put it in a reserve and have it there for 6 years, and then it has to be reversed to added back to taxation. And since this is a 6 year limit and the recapture rule is 5 year, then they have specifically commented on this and kind of what the options would be. So some things have been clarified, some things, of course, not. We do have other things like excess depreciations on machinery and fixed assets, which has also been commented by the government, how to actually handle the deferred tax, which is related to differences between plan book depreciations and tax depreciations. So some specific things have been commented, and in those cases we can be, of course, clearer to the client. In the cases where it hasn't been commented, it's a bit wait and see approach, I would say, as we tend to take to the client and wait and see a little bit, actually.
I think it's broadly in line with what all of you've just been said. It's a very difficult position as an advisor, how to position yourself. It was also a very controversially discussed topic in Luxembourg, whether or not like some of this additional guidance is like not in line with the current version of the directive and therefore not in line with like our interpretation within Europe. In general, I strongly lean towards like following OECD guidance. I mean, all of the EU member states basically are also OECD members, so it would be a bit of an absurd way of like deciding on a consensus approach and then say, but in the same countries that have opted and voted for a certain approach in the OECD guidance, we would then say, yeah, but it's not in line with our EU directive. So it, from a legal perspective, the conclusion might be different. That's more like my common sense interpretation. I think as long as it's not in line, like strictly speaking, in line with the black letter law or the directive, I think we should always follow the OECD guidance because that's what it's there for. And I think yesterday there was another clarification that was also issued by the European Council and the Commission. It's still in draft form, if I understood correctly, but that they at least acknowledge and recognize the binding character of OECD guidance. So that's at least one welcoming approach for harmonization there. But indeed, like if you really have like face a situation where like the additional guidance is really not in line with the wording of the law, then you do have an issue, because how can you opine on something as an advisor against the black letter wording of the law? And that's a really, really tricky situation for all of us.
I like to echo my comment that I made that the OECD is not a democratic legitimized body, and now it is actually everyone is looking for what the OECD is doing. And obviously, like from a formality standpoint, it is still the parliament who has to decide on it. But I guess by now we can certainly say that nearly none of the members of the parliament have the capacity to actually understand all the rules and what kind of consequences they have in practice. So it's like a very weird outcome.
Pachi, how is it for you in Spain living in uncertainty, and it's just a, you know, uncertainty topic?
Yeah, we have similar issues here in Spain, and I have to say that I do agree with what Nadia just said right now. In Spain, references to OECD papers have caused problems in the past because they are just soft law under our legal system. And we have cases, for example, with interpretation of double tax treaties, in which the model convention has evolved and has changed some of the interpretations of the concepts that are within the tax treaties, but the wording of the tax treaties didn't change at all. We have had some decisions of the courts rejecting the dynamic interpretation of the OECD's papers, and so this could be the case in which we have something that will be likely stable or fixed, like the directive and the in the law, in the domestic law in each country. While I think that the the likely thing to happen with the guidance is that we will have new papers of the OECD, not only interpreting, but also changing some of the things that are within the report of the OECD. And so, I mean, that may cause a problem in Spain because the position of the tax courts have always been strict in the cases in which there is a paper of OECD in this case or other kind of organization that is against the wording of the domestic law. And once again, we don't have visibility on how the Spanish law will look like. I guess that we have things like this with transfer pricing, with interpretation of treaties. The law production process in Spain is complex, and I don't expect to have a very, very complete domestic law, including all the things that the guidance of the OECD says. And I guess that this will be a source of controversy between taxpayers and tax authorities in the future.
Yeah, exactly. If you make like a dynamic reference directly to the OECD guidance and you avoid problem, but then it enhances the problem that you outsource your exercising power of issuing law.
And it's not the parliament the one that is issuing this.
No, it's representatives of the tax administrations that comes together.
Yeah, that's an issue.
So apart from the legislative process, do you have specific examples where you see that the new rules are causing a consequence that is obviously not intended or should not be intended by the Pillar 2 rules, for example? And in Germany, we have a couple of questions relating to German GAAP because we would not show DTAs unless we elect to, or we do not tax equity participations, even if they're under 10%. So do you have similar examples where you would say, okay, this is a surprising outcome, Pachi?
We have some incentives in our tax system. And as we discussed earlier, I mean, the aim of the Pillar 2 is just to remove the effect of the main part of these tax incentives, or let's say equalize the tax systems within the world. But we have at least three of them that have been or will be impacted by Pillar 2, and I want to remark them. First of all, in the Canary Island, there is a special tax regime, but this is due to the fact that the islands are more than 2 kilometers away from the European continent, and so any kind of investment needs kind of incentive, and that's the aim of this their special tax regime, and so many of the companies implemented in the Canary Island may have a problem of undertaxation under these rules. And I guess that this is, I mean, to cause such a problem to a region like this is not something that the OECD or the European Union was not thinking at all. Second, I will also to explain that we have a kind of a special companies that are called cooperativas, that are collective partnership companies owned by their employees, in which a big part of the profit has to be reinvested with specific purposes. For example, compulsory non-refundable reserves, or reserve for promotion and education, or other kind of specific uses like environmental uses. In a nutshell, their work like not exactly non-profit entities, but they have many restrictions that link to this kind of concept. But they are not included, or they don't fit into the definition of the Pillar 2 rules of non-profit entities. And so we have some clients that are within this world and will face problems of under taxation with the new rules. And then finally, there is a special regime in the Basque Country in which, let's say, bearing or summarizing, we have some corporate income tax incentives because on in general, our personal income tax is higher than in the rest of Spain. So the citizens like it's like the citizens we decided to have this kind of system in which the corporations have a better treatment or some kind of incentives in exchange of higher tax rates for ourselves. And so maybe this is not such a clear case as the other two, but there are some things that cases in which that we are not talking about, let's say, unfair tax competition or that kind of things that should be the focus of the pilot too.
So it goes a bit in the direction of an eligible distribution system like you have in the Baltic states. Sometimes you tax the company gains profits low and therefore you tax the shareholders a little bit higher. Yeah, it takes a lot of freedom away to channel your investments, especially to areas that need incentives. That is a problem. Maria, what kind of examples do you see in Sweden where you think, oh, this is a surprising outcome?
One of the things we have reflected on is, I mean, one of the first steps for many of our clients have been to look at the safe harbors as a first step before going into any full rules calculation. So looking at the safe harbors, one of the things which surprised us was maybe that in some cases we've seen that the clients we thought would be able to use safe harbors are not able to use safe harbors. And that could be, for instance, if they are transaction intense group with real estate, etc., doing many transactions, which are share-based deals, which means that they could be subject to domestic participation exemption rules in Sweden, meaning that they don't pay tax on the transfer of the shares. And but still looking at the country-by-country figures, which are to be used for the safe harbor in relation to the simplified ETR test in the safe harbor, that would mean that those groups could have quite a high amount of profit before income tax in their country-by-country figures. But while they wouldn't have any tax on the transaction made, so that would mean, in many cases that kind of transaction intense group would not be able to use the simplified ETR test under the safe harbor rules, which, I mean, it's difficult to say if that was something which was intended or not, but it's for sure something which, surprised us. That was one of the things we've thought about. And other than that, it's been quite a lot of questions kind of coming up under more the structure questions, the ultimate parent entity questions, and which is the responsible company within the group. In many cases, there have been reorganizations within the group, within this time frame during the preceding years. So a lot of questions linked to that. And of course, it's outlining the Pillar 2 rules. It's difficult to predict all situations, of course.
Yeah, that's a bit what we see as well, where you questioning yourself, okay, should you just apply like how you do it for accounting purposes and you just like follow without questioning it, or you try to really do the analysis? And then when you want to clarify it, you think like, okay, if I clarify it, I might make them think about this case and then it goes into the law and it would not be in the law if I wouldn't raise that issue. So it's like, yeah, the tax administration is really sitting in a more comfortable position because we are like guessing how to apply the law and they're just waiting. And then they say like, okay, I'm looking at all the cases and then I pick the best choice. And Andreas, how is the fund industry affected by it?
I think the Pillar 2 rules, they were also intending to capture like a part of specific fund structures, but like to a vast extent, I think it was not expected that like there'd be some like collateral damage. And the problem is like we cannot even assess that at this point in time because there are so many clarifications missing that we don't even know to which extent we will have a problem. And what I noticed like personally a lot from a Luxembourg perspective, and I think that impacts also other countries, there seems to be some kind of a discrimination depending on the accounting standard you're using. And that's something which I find a little bit frustrating because many of these rules, they were like strongly oriented towards IFRS. There were a lot of clarifications giving like certainty for IFRS M&E groups. But if we are looking at like continental Europe, there's like a lot of like difficult questions that are like entirely clear, but which have a huge impact later on. In Luxembourg, we have like a very similar issue as you in Germany. Like it even goes farther because we don't, Lux gap rules do not provide for loss DTAs, for example. And the question is now, how can we make sure that like M&E groups in the scope of Pillar 2 that are using Luxembourg gap for their consolidation do not lose their tax attributes, so do not lose the capacity to use their losses? That's a highly controversial point in Luxembourg, for example. Or there's like a number of examples on that you could name, like what one major aspect for the fund industry being the certain exemptions from consolidation, because we have roughly like, I don't know, like a dozen of different exemptions from consolidation under Luxembourg fund laws, company law, and even other special laws. So like it's not even one harmonized legal basis. And we basically have like very few clarity on like what are good and bad exemptions from consolidation that would potentially require a deemed consolidation, which would trigger a hugely burdensome process of preparing shadow consolidation accounts just for the purposes of Pillar 2. And one example is, for example, that is strongly in favor of using IFRS. If you're an investment entity, for example, it's clearly clarified by OECD guidance that you're not like the parent entity because you're not consolidating, even though you have 100% shareholdings, for example. But given that you are an investment entity under IFRS, you're not required to consolidate and you're just fair valuing your investments. And we have very similar, like in terms of philosophy, very similar exemptions from consolidation in Luxembourg. For example, the so-called private equity exemption, which is very comparable. But in terms of wording, it's closely aligned to one of those detrimental exemptions that is explicitly mentioned in the directive, like this held for sale or held for resale exemption that explicitly requires a deemed consolidation. So this is something where I find it a little bit frustrating that IFRS taxpayers or groups are a little bit favored because they have clarity on this. Although like Luxembourg or even German groups that rely on similar exemptions, but which are like, let's say, like a bit more unfortunately phrased if you compare it to the detrimental exemptions under Pillar 2, maybe dragged into the scope of Pillar 2. So there's like a certain discrepancy between different accounting standards, also depending on like a lot of this optionality is also linked to the effective taxation at the level further up. For example, thinking about insurance groups, which are looking investing into funds that elect for the transparency option, for example. That's only possible if you have a mark-to-market taxation in your home country, which basically excludes most of continental Europe because we're taxed on realized income and not taxed on unrealized income. So that's what I find particularly unfair, to be very honest, that we have this discrimination depending on the accountant standards, that you're deprived from even electing certain optionality just because of the accounting standard that you're applying at UPE level. So this is just like a very short, brief selection of issues that we came across that we do not consider as explicitly intended.
What are you doing in terms of lobbying? Now, when I hear the example of you, Patxi, and of you and Andreas with the cooperativas that could be an entity, and your example, Andreas, with the loss carry forwards or now with the consolidation under IFRS, we had the same discussion because under German GAAP, we also have a lot of Deutscher Mittelstand, you know, the backbone of the German economy, and they use a German gap, and they would not necessarily make use of the election to show deferred tax assets for losses. And there has now been another discussion, which also because Germany initiated the global minimum taxation, so it would be particularly bad if German taxpayers would be treated worse than US GAAP or IFRS applicants. But whether the fact that you can determine those DTAs, even though you don't show them in the books, you could still recognize them. And my question is, to which extent do you, like, are your clients organized or lobbying it or bringing that to the attention of the OECD? Because I know that there is a business advisory group at the level of the OECD, but it's more, I think there are no funds or banks represented so far. But from my experience, if you raise the issue or if you push it with the, with the Luxembourgish government in that case, there might still be place to adapt something, because it would be very impacting for European investors.
Yeah, fully agreed. I think on the Luxembourg front, there was like a lot of lobbying going on, like in the sense of like explaining potential issues to the relevant, like the legislator. The problem is that we still do not have a running government. So some of these very key issues, they will hopefully be decided on at some point. But so far, like the Second Amendment has still left a few questions open. But at least we've had like a lot more of this optionality inserted in the second draft law. But it's due to this very specific political environment at the moment in Luxembourg that I think some of these really key issues will potentially be postponed to a later point in time.
In my case, in Spain, the delay in the production of the Spanish law also has made that in general the affected companies are in the phase of analyzing the directive and maybe not so focused on lobbying. And apart from that, I guess that many of our clients, or some of them at least, may be trying to reach up to the ministry and make their proposals. But sometimes it's something that we as advisors don't really know what's happening behind the curtains.
In German, we say "steter Tropfen hüllt den Stein," like continuous effort to get your exemption, basically. Joe, what do you see from your practice in advising US MNEs operating around the world?
Yeah, it's interesting listening to everyone discuss, you know, sort of these, that what I would call minutiae, very small discrepancies between local accounting rules and the Pillar 2 rules, which are going to be all over the place. We are a little bit... we're not quite there yet. We're still wrestling with sort of the big issues. How does U.S. law, how could it ever coexist neatly with Pillar 2? Hey, one example, we're starting to advise clients on, how to interact guilty and subpart F with the Pillar 2 rules. You know, when this all started, I think folks thought, boy, this looks... The Pillar 2 rules look a lot like guilty. They look a lot like subpart F. We can probably find a way to make the two coexist kind of neatly. And it took a long time to get to a sort of a compromise option. But the blended CFC regime rules came out in February, tried to do that. We're already starting to see how they don't always work with the existing guilty regime and the Pillar 2 regime. One example of that is... where you have minority owners. So suppose you had a 60% M&E member, constituent entity, that owns 60% of a subsidiary, a 40% owner that is not a constituent entity and does not consolidate with the group. But that 40% owner is a U.S. shareholder, a U.S. person who's required to apply guilty to a low-tax subsidiary. Those guilty amounts, if suppose you had a partially owned parent entity that owned a lower tier sub that was required to collect 100% of the taxes attributable, top up taxes attributable to that low tax sub, none of the guilty that's collected at the 40% U.S. shareholder level gets pushed down to the CFC because that minority owner is not a constituent entity. that's a problem, right? And that's going to pop up all over the place where you'll get economic taxation at the US level, a guilty tax that is at least in part, potentially entirely attributable to the low tax income of the constituent entity down the chain. But none of that guilty gets allocated down. This is one example of where these rules don't quite line up. And clients are starting to see that. And that's just sort of scratching the surface. We haven't even tried to put these rules into our domestic law yet. Like, remains to be seen that the issues are going to be many.
Yeah, that's why in Europe we choose to have separate laws so we do not have to integrate it in the current taxation systems.
We see a lot of complexity is coming with Pillar 2. Do you have some discussion or maybe also concrete implementation of the simplification of other rules in your country? For example, in Germany, we see a reduction of the CFC tax percentage from 25% to 15%. And we see also a revocation of the license barrier rule. Do you have some examples and discussions in your country, Patchy?
There have to be some adaptations. But we don't have visibility yet. We don't even know, and that's a question for the rest of you, if this will be treated as a new chapter of the corporate income tax or as a brand new tax. This is, you know, on our internal legal system, this is a question. This is a matter because depending on how it's treated or how is it's born, and there we have some internal competencies between different bodies and different tax administrations, or it just can be treated as a national tax. So it's different, and I don't know if in the case of the adaptation of the directive in your countries, if you can explain a little bit how it has been treated.
Yeah, actually, this was our last episode in our German tax podcast. And in the end, it's between. So we have now in our legislation that it's a part of the corporate income tax, but it's not in a quietly new tax. And it's part of the corporate income tax, but it's more something between. And this, in the background, is also that our constitutional law, needs or give us this way that the answer is something between both of them.
For me, it's clearly a special tax. Also, like looking at the whole framework, it's a complete new shadow system that you like put next to the existing system, which was already like quite complex at times. And I think this just makes the level of complexity explode. But that's probably something for one of the last conclusions on this topic. We have been discussing a couple of things to align the results between like Luxembourg local tax rules and IFRS rules. Pillar 2 rules, in order to make sure that like there's like, you know, at least an option to reduce the administrative burden. And that rather included some measures which were not in favor of the taxpayer, like, for example, opting out of participation exemption regimes, because we also have like the conceptual issue that the Luxembourg participation exemption, implementing the parent subsidiary directive, is a bit more generous than like the Pillar 2 rules, which are like sticking to the 10% threshold, basically, except for long-term dividends. And we have like a lot of discrepancies here. And that there was one point that was discussed, which has unfortunately not yet been at least respected or considered in the law, to have some kind of opt-out mechanisms to at least align the results. Meaning that like you can opt out to be taxed at a higher level or increase your tax base. So that's the kind of simplification we've been discussing, but even that hasn't been factored in yet.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, in Sweden, it's by no doubt, it's a separate law, separate legislation, like an extra layer. And I mean, it's a national tax. I would say it's an additional corporate tax. But so far, we haven't seen any suggested simplifications or in any way any simplifications suggested so far. So nothing, nothing. But maybe there is to come, but we haven't seen any indications of that so far. And we do also, like in Luxembourg and like Andreas mentioned, we do also have differences between our domestic participation exemption rules and the definition of portfolio shareholdings, for instance, where it makes differences. But we haven't seen anything other than in this additional, this new legislation. They do have a definition of portfolio shareholdings and how you calculate everything. But then we still, however, in another law, we do have the domestic participation exemptions.
In Germany, we could, like, following discussions about simplification, you could see that there was a quite clear division between the different parties. So there was the Green Party or the Social Democrats that were more worried about, like, when giving in to simplifications, that it would reduce tax income for the state. So it's a clear political role here as well. Joe, you mentioned in the beginning the role about Pillar 2 and how the Democrats were in favor and the Biden ministry is also in favor. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about Pillar 2, what kind of role it plays in the current election process.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We typically in the U.S., tax issues are front and center. They're typically an item of discussion in a presidential campaign in any election, but usually the discussion's fairly broad. It's surface level. It's, you know, higher taxes on the wealthy or, you know, cutting taxes for the middle class, the usual talking points. I've been surprised over the last year at the level of discourse about the global minimum tax. This is something that's become relevant for, you know, mainstream political discussion. It has always been something that the Biden administration has pushed, basically as a way to say we're cracking down on tax avoidance by major corporations. That's something they've said, and it's not surprising they've said that. But it's been really surprising to me that Republicans in the U.S. have pushed back so strongly against this and used Pillar 2 as a political talking point. They've had several hearings in Congress to discuss what I would call, again, to use this word, minutia, you know, the impact of the UTPR on U.S. research credits, which is something obviously I advise on, but not something I would have expected many, non-tax specialists to care much about. This is certainly something people have talked about. Whether this is going to be a deciding factor or a very, very important factor in the election is uncertain, and it probably won't be. But it's certainly a something that will be discussed, and is, as you mentioned, breaks down upon party lines. Democrats clearly in favor of the Pillar 2 reforms that Republicans sort of clearly opposed. Will this tip the scales in one way or the other in the election? Probably not, but it's interesting just how much airtime it's gotten.
But how would you actually, I mean, you already mentioned how is UTPR affecting research credits. How would you actually align Pillar 2 with the Income Inflation Reduction Act? Sorry.
Yeah, it already is in a way aligned. The IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, as you mentioned, has sort of two pieces. The first is the series of tax credits, mostly for green energy projects, some of which are aligned with Pillar 2 in the sense that they are refundable directly. And so they're treated favorably as a QRTC, qualified refundable tax credit, that's treated as income under the GLOBE rules rather than as a reduction to cover taxes, which is favorable. You've also got others that are transferable. So that the classic way that tax credits were monetized in the U.S. before the IRA, was through some sort of tax equity partnership structure. The IRA tried to reform that treatment a bit and say, you know, with some credits can just be directly bought and sold instead of needing to go through one of these structures. Those also received somewhat complex, but generally favorable guidance under the model rules, the administrative guidance in July. So that is a little bit integrated. There are still credits remaining that are neither transferable nor refundable. And those, I think, sort of clearly under current rules would be treated as reductions to tax. And so that aligns with the way our existing credits are treated, the research credit being one of them. That's going to be a big sticking point. The U.S. is clearly out of step and likely would disagree with the way the Pillar 2 rules have gone. The other piece is our corporate alternative minimum tax, or what people call CAMPTI, which is a 15% minimum tax on financial statement income that's in our domestic law. It's just not quite the same as the Pillar 2 rules. It relies on sort of U.S. principles of taxation. It's not, you know, it's not a gap-based tax, although it is sort of close to one. And it relies on the GILTI and Subpart F and those existing regimes. So it's not exactly the same as Pillar 2, but it's close enough where you could see tweaks to that regime being made to bring the U.S. closer to Pillar 2 compliance if you really wanted to do it.
Coming back on Patrick's point in the beginning and difficulties, for example, like areas like the Canary Islands to attract investment, and now looking at the summer OECD guidance, like stating that most of the U.S. credits are actually treated as global income and not as a reduction of tax. Can you see, like, in reality, in effect, that there's a lot of investment coming to the U.S. Due to this project? Do you have a lot of European M&Es investing under these beneficial regimes?
Yeah, absolutely. The credits that were brought in by both the IRA, these green credits, and then a regime that would subject to a different law called the CHIPS Act, which was to encourage semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. Both have had, I mean, from my view, very large stimulating impacts on investment in the U.S. Clients are setting up facilities in the U.S., and we're told that the reason they're doing so is because of the existence of credits. The credits are so generous that they are making the cost to invest in the U.S. clearly better than investments in other jurisdictions. It's not just European M&Es, it's Asian M&Es as well, Latin American M&Es, who are choosing to invest in the U.S. because of these credits. Interestingly, one question we frequently get is, hey, if I put my factory in your jurisdiction and I claim all these credits, what's the likelihood that they're just going to be clawed back by some other country under Pillar 2? That's been a big area of advice we're giving. Are these QRTCs, is there something about them that makes it risky and you should think about how to structure the investment so that it doesn't contain this risk? Are they clearly not QRTCs, and so this is not going to be, or very likely not going to be, a good investment if the UTPR goes into effect and taxes U.S. activity, or you've got a TOPCO somewhere else with an IIR? These are the sorts of questions we get over and over. Putting Pillar 2 aside, which creates this sort of uncertainty, there's no question that the credits themselves are having a direct positive effect on the U.S. economy.
Andreas, do you see also your clients investing more in the U.S. than in Europe? Do you see a shift?
I wouldn't say it's mainly driven by the current state of the legislation. I think it's more driven, or yet still driven, by economic factors. But I think it'll play a bigger role in the future, because I think it's not to be underestimated that certain incentives, as Joe also just mentioned, are completely eliminated by another country, like depending on the combination of parent and subsidiary country, which makes it a little bit absurd to kind of completely circumvent incentives that a given country is willing to give at its own expense and the tax, which is then subsequently collected by another jurisdiction. It's we're getting to a world where it's the decision to make investments is more and more impacted by tax laws, and that shouldn't be the philosophy of tax law, to drive investments negative or impact them negatively. Create incentives, that's I think something which is legitimate. But hampering investment, that cannot be the goal or the objective of any country that's participating there. And that's the big danger I see here.
I would say, like Andreas, we haven't really seen kind of the shift so clearly yet. What to predict, what to come, but we haven't seen it so far.
Yeah, I'm with Andreas and Maria. I didn't see the case of any of my clients considering to shift their business to the US. But yeah, I have seen clients with interests in the and investments in the US and changing their mindset in respect to the US tax system in the last 6, 7, 8 years since the tax reform. And I think that this Pillar 2 question is not an autonomous one. This is part of a tendency. Mm. And I think that in the future, we will see how this impacts, but we will see that in general, investors that can opt will look to the US tax system much better than in general, or broadly speaking, the European tax system.
Yeah, I think it's not only Pillar 2, it's maybe also like BFIT and all the other DAX 6, whatever, all the other European initiatives that seem to be hampering investment and make life more difficult and not more attractive. And I can say from my experience, all the larger investments decisions, they're not taking place in Europe anymore. So there's like if you look in the next 5 years, there, the next plants, they're not being built in Germany because not because of 15% taxes, or in Germany you pay higher taxes anyways, but just because it appears to be very unreliable, the investment climate and what is coming in terms of measures. Well, the feedback is Inflation Reduction Act, like giving certainty for a 10-year span is just very attractive because you know what to deal with for a certain period that allows you to monetize your investment.
So we are coming now to our last question. So usually we have kind of yes or no questions, and maybe you can also answer with a yes or no. I don't know if this is possible or not. And this is also coming from our co-hosts from NIOF. After 10 years discussion on BEPS, on your overall view, do you think Pillar 2 is a success or not? I start with Paji.
No, especially if the US doesn't support the cause.
Maria?
No, given the amount of compliance work this will generate, and also, I would say, I mean, achieve its objectives is in one way, yes, but you don't know really what will come in terms of other rules, kind of doing it more favorable to invest in simplification rules or rules for giving benefits instead. So it's not really like it for sure would reduce the race to the bottom.
Andreas, what do you think?
Well, so clear no. And I think one of the main reasons being, and similar to what Pachi also said, I think it's going to impact US outbound investments into Europe like massively, especially if there's some kind of protective or retaliation measures being implemented by the US. And I think that's going to hurt. And then we're basically like making sure that all the capital flows will flow around Europe and not into Europe anymore. And that's something that can clearly not be in our interest. So I think from a philosophical perspective, I support the idea, but the way this has been implemented is like excessively bureaucratic and uncertain, and nothing kills business more than uncertainty, and especially like without US implication, I think it doesn't make sense the way it is right now.
And Joe?
Well, I'm glad I didn't have to be the only one to say this. I also agree. I think if the goal was to create an incredible amount of new compliance work, then mission accomplished. If the goal was to raise revenue and achieve a level playing field. Favorable, sure, exactly, tax system, I think the answer is sort of very clearly no.
Nadia?
Oh, I have to answer that question too. I'm with Andreas. Like the ideal to have a level playing field and to have everyone pay the same amount of tax, yes, it's a good idea. But what we see, I mean, it's basically putting a new tax system. There are so many loopholes already. Like you don't even have to search for them. You stumble above them and think, oh, this is a surprising outcome in both ways, in a very negative way and also in a in a way where you circumvent the rules without even intending it. So it's obviously it's like it's a new law from the whiteboard. So our tax law started to be very easy as well, and we spent 100 years fixing the holes. And this will just be the same work, just that we have now an additional layer. So it's great times to be an advisor.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, my answer is that I hope that in 10 years we can see, yes, it was a success. But I think we need a lot of time to fix all these issues. So usually we have now our service to give some references to the text journals to dig deeper on this. Today, this short, we just refer to our last episode on Pillar 2, where we have a lot of references to the literature. We just want to mention that, of course, you find a lot of things to read in the portal, on the portal of NVB and EVB. And now I hand over to the last part to Nadia.
Thank you to all of the guests in the studio today. Thank you for taking the time and providing us with your insights. It was really interesting to get your views, and I'm sure we could have talked for the rest of the day, but we only have 1 hour. The last part I will do in German for our listeners that are listening to German, or maybe I do it in both languages because we have also English-speaking listeners. So we have an email address. It's called textquartet@nwb.de. And if you have any ideas, if you want to have another series presented in English, please don't hesitate to give us your ideas or provide us with your feedback, how you like this episode. And now in German, für unsere deutschsprachigen Hörer, auch von Ihnen sind wir gespannt zu hören, wie Ihnen diese englischsprachige Folge gefallen hat, ob Sie das eine gute Idee finden, ob wir das nochmal machen sollen. Gerne Feedback an textquartet@nwb.de und vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.
Thank you all for joining.
Das war das Textquartett, der Podcast zum internationalen Steuerrecht vom NWB Verlag in Zusammenarbeit mit We Are Producers. Bleiben Sie up to date im Steuerrecht unter www.nwb.de.